Hello, I'm Jerry Bradley. This is number 0251, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0251. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Douglas Liebling, who is a well-respected TV writer who has just written his first novel for young readers called Flight of the Akiro, The Book of Milo. With his busy TV schedule, what made him write a book?
I was inspired at first by my two teen boys. They were looking for things to read, and I thought, well, I can do that for you guys. And then I also, in writing for television, it is a very collaborative art form, which I love, and it's terrific to be in. But the writer never gets to have his own voice. It's always influenced by a variety of different factors, studio concerns, network concerns, limitations of your actors or your budget. And I wanted the chance to, after 20 years of writing, to do something that was entirely me.
Ron Shuchuk, author of Barbecue Secrets Deluxe, shares some barbecue tips. What's the biggest mistake people make when barbecuing?
Just walking away from the grill. For 90% of the things that people actually put on a grill, whether it's a chicken breast or a steak or a smoky or whatever it is, it really doesn't take more than 2 or 3 minutes per side to cook something. Maybe it, for a thicker steak or something you really need to cook through, maybe it's 10 minutes. But people walk away and forget whatever they're cooking is on the grill. They come back and the thing looks like a hockey puck.
Relationship coach Frank Kermit talks about May-December relationships. They're not quite the taboo that they used to be.
It was more than forbidden. It was actively discouraged. People would step in and use shame and guilt and how could you and why are you wasting your time? This relationship can't go anywhere. The only reason you're getting together is for sex because there's no way you're ever going to produce children in this relationship. And that's really a big part of the underlying reason that it was a stigma. Nowadays, people tend to mind their own business. Live and let live. Do whatever you want to do as long as it doesn't interfere with my life.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0251 was Jerry Bradley, who was a logistics consultant and someone that I went to school with way back when, you know, just after the earth cooled. Thank you very much, Jerry, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Frantic zookeepers rush to call an ambulance after a vet shot a tranquilizer dart at a man dressed as a gorilla. Police on the Spanish island of Tenerife received a call from a panicked member of the public who said that a gorilla had escaped from its pen at Loro Zoo, that's the Loro Park Zoo, and was seen running around the theme park. Now, a vet was called and, on spotting the creature, fired a tranquilizer dart at its leg with enough sedative to fell a 450-pound beast. But to his horror, the vet, who, by the way, had only been on the job for 2 months, realized that the creature was, in fact, an employee of the zoo dressed in a gorilla suit who was staging a mock escape to practice their emergency routines. The 35-year-old man was taken to the island's university hospital after the shooting. He was said to be in a serious condition, having suffered an allergic reaction to the tranquilizer, but was expected to make a full recovery. Okay, what I would like to know is whose idea is it to stage a mock escape when there are members of the public around? That's what I want to know. Anyway, 20,000 feet above Nashville, LaShonda Lee Williams made everyone on Flight 4205 feel really comfortable and relaxed when she told a fellow passenger, "I kill white people like you." The 43-year-old Williams was asked by another female passenger to turn off her cell phone due to the aircraft being in flight, according to a court affidavit. Now, in reply, Williams made the alleged statement. Investigators noted that Williams told the other passenger, Kay Colleen Colt, that she would follow her upon reaching Houston and find out where she lived. The flight returned to Nashville Airport, where LaShonda Lee Williams was arrested for assault. Does anybody remember the exact date when flying turned into the Greyhound bus in the sky? Yikes. Moving right along, it was around 2:15 a.m., and Dunwoody, Georgia police officer Alvin Rodriguez was on patrol when another car smashed into him and then simply drove off. Naturally, Rodriguez, who was not injured, pursued the offending car, and when it pulled over, he asked the driver for his license. 37-year-old Damon Tobias Exum apparently needed Rodriguez to haul something for him so he could pull out his wallet. What he wanted him to hold, by the way, was his beer. Sure enough, a police spokesman says, Exum was heavily intoxicated and totally unaware that he had collided with the officer's patrol car. He was arrested on multiple charges, including DUI, which, by the way, was his third offense, and reckless driving. Now, usually hold my beer and watch this happens long before police involvement, but I digress. Now, these stories are kind of sad, actually. I have been lucky enough, or unlucky enough, depending how you look at it, to have two separate accidents with drunk drivers who didn't have a clue or couldn't buy a vowel, totally unaware of the fact that they were even in an accident. And by the way, third offense for this guy? Why do they keep giving people so many chances with 3,000 pounds of murderous steel? I have no idea. Anyway, we have time for one more story before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. The employees at a Waffle House restaurant in Norcross, Georgia, knew there was going to be trouble. When the man walked in, he was wearing a ski mask and carrying a pitchfork. Talk about American Gothic. Yeah. Sure enough, the man announced a robbery. He used the pitchfork to herd the employees into a back room and then went to the cash register. Said police officer Warren Summers, when he realized he couldn't get the cash register open, he took the whole cash register and exited the store with his pitchfork. Yeah. Employees followed him out to the parking lot, and in the excitement, the robber dropped the pitchfork. An employee picked it up and chased after him. As the robber jumped into his pickup truck, still carrying the cash register, the employee used the pitchfork to smash the truck's back window. Police later arrested a suspect, 50-year-old Jeffrey Willard Wooten, and, of course, commented on his unusual weapon. This is a quote by Officer Summers. It wouldn't be an offensive weapon in your garden, but it was in a Waffle House. Yeah. Well, you know, so are the waffles, but I digress. What I'd like to know is at what point did Jeffrey decide that an armed robbery using a pitchfork was a good idea? And by the way, I wonder how the NRA feels about pitchforks. I almost made Jeffrey the idiot of the day, by the way. I came oh so close, because he's right on the borderline of being a full-fledged idiot. But I do have an idiot of the day coming, of course, at the end of the program, and I think the person that we're going to get to a little later on certainly qualifies more than Jeffrey. Let's just say that Jeffrey here would be, idiot adjacent. Yeah. That's what we'll call it. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Douglas Liebling is a television writer-producer who has worked on such shows as Hannah Montana and Life with Boys. He is currently working as the writer and co-executive producer of Nickelodeon's Nicky, Ricky, Dicky, and Don. And if that's not enough, he has also penned his first novel entitled Flight of the Akiro, The Book of Milo, which is why he is joining us on the line right now from California. Hi, Douglas.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So as I list your credits, clearly you have worked a lot with young audiences. What is the attraction for you?
It is, you know, I spent the beginning of my career writing primetime half hours for adults, and I fell into writing for youth television when I got my first sort of youth television job on Hannah Montana, and it is... As I've found, so much more gratifying. You make such a big impact on these kids when you are entertaining them and subversively educating them so much more than you make on adults who take in entertainment as fluff and then just let it go right through their brains and out the other side. What we wrote on Hannah or on Life with Boys or any of those teen shows sticks with its audience. And that's really gratifying when you're creating that.
With technology moving so fast, and let's be honest, we are getting older, does it make it more difficult to connect with a younger audience who terminology and technology changes so rapidly for them? How do you keep up?
Yeah, it's very difficult to keep up with the way kids speak. However, I'm blessed, or as my wife would tell me, she's cursed with the fact that I'm 12 years old and will never grow up at heart. And the core issues and the childishness of a teen never changes. They're always interested in the same things. The same kinds of things are important to them when we were kids or the kids today. It's just trying to get your mind around the new languages that they speak, the new words they say. But it's always underneath it all the same stuff.
So all this work in television that you have done and are currently doing, you've now taken a little bit of time and also penned this first novel. What made you decide that you wanted to branch out in this direction?
Well, I was inspired at first by my two teen boys. They were looking for things to read, and I thought, well, I can do that for you guys. And then I also, in writing for television, it is a very collaborative art form, which I love, and it's terrific to be in. But the writer never gets to have his own voice. It's always influenced by a variety of different factors: studio concerns, network concerns, limitations of your actors, or your budgets, or however you want to box it in. It's always boxed in. It's never really a painting that the writer paints. And I wanted the chance to, after 20 years of writing, to paint something, to do something that was entirely me. And so I took on this challenge, not thinking that I'd ever be able to finish it, and I surprised myself and did it.
So the book is called Flight of the Akiro, The Book of Milo. First of all, what does the title mean?
Oh, you have to read the book to find out.
Ah.
It is the story of a young teen named Milo who's searching for connections in the world and searching for a place to belong. And he may or may not take flight during the book, metaphorically.
Aha, uh-huh. I see.
I can't give too much away. I can't tell you what exactly it means. There are mysteries to be unraveled in even the title.
Now, one of the other things, too, is we live in such a politically correct world today. Does it make it difficult writing stories for teens in that world that we live in? Because people are always wanting to criticize or nitpick depictions of characters or phrases or things that are said in movies, television, and film these days, particularly if they're for young audiences.
Oh, absolutely. In my television work, we are constantly looking over our shoulders and petrified of making a misstep. And we do it out of a responsibility to our audience. We don't want to say anything or do anything offensive or hurtful. We want to make sure that we're a safe place for parents to let their kids be entertained. The book, on the other hand, I let myself have a little more freedom with that. I cared a little less. I wrote it for myself, for my children, and I wasn't handcuffed so much by caring what other people were going to think. I have a moral compass, and I believe that the book is appropriate for everybody and is not offensive and sends a good message. I'm sure other people will read passages from it and disagree, but I didn't really overthink it too much in the book, and that was part of the freedom of it, and I loved that piece of writing it.
The writing muscle that you use to write this book, is it different than the way you would write for television?
Oh, absolutely. It is a completely different art form. As I like to say to people who ask that question, my friends who are saying, oh, well, you can write that. You write a screenplay, you write a book, it's all the same thing, right? And I say to them, no, it's like a dentist becoming a brain surgeon. They're both doctors, but it's a completely different art form. It's a whole different way of writing that I had to sort of teach myself. Okay, don't do this, do that. Make sure that you're writing, you're not writing in your television form, you're writing in your author head. And it's a difficult thing to switch back and forth because I was constantly doing both each day. I would go to work writing television and come home and write the book, and I had to completely switch gears. And it was not very easy, but doable.
Double question. When you write as a screenwriter, do you visualize the scenes? And conversely, is that something you do with a book or not?
Yes, absolutely. Constantly closing my eyes and trying to live in that world. It's funny, I have a few friends who helped me through this process who were screenwriters or television writers who had switched over and written novels. And they all say the same thing, which is you end up writing, you're describing the screenplay when you first start, because that's the way you think as a screenwriter or a television writer. And you have to sort of break yourself of that habit, but you never break yourself of the habit of actually closing your eyes and seeing it happen in front of you.
So someone who writes a lot of screenplays, now that you've got this book out, would you like to see it on the screen in some way, shape, or form?
Ooh, that's such a hard question, because I have a very strong belief that they're two separate things. I'm a huge, huge Harry Potter fan, both film and the books. I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan, both television series and the books, but I think they're completely separate things, and I really love the books more in both cases, and I don't know if I would be able to detach and let a movie or a television series be made of the book or books as I hope to get the trilogy out. I'm not sure I'd be able to let it go that way. Of course, when, you know, Hollywood backs the Brinks truck up, I'm not going to say no. But at the moment right now, I love that it's a book and I love what it is in its own form. And I'm not that excited or interested about creating it in a separate form just yet. We'll see.
Well, as a screenwriter, screenwriters often write scripts that are original content, but they also often do adaptations. Does this change your mind on how you would do an adaptation of someone's work because you've now written a book?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I had in the past as an exercise written an adaptation of a science fiction novel that I really felt I had the ownership of. I felt, I know exactly what this is, and I ripped it apart and put it back together. And now being an author, I can see it from the author's point of view and think to myself when I read that piece, ooh, I'm really glad this never went anywhere and the author never saw it. Because it would be heartbreaking if someone had done that to Flight of the Akira.
Well, sometimes they say that, you know, your harshest critics are within your own home. You said you wrote this for your two boys. What is their reaction?
Well, they're still teen boys, so they'll never let you know they like anything. However, they were very interested in continuing to read. I showed it to them chapter by chapter. They were my harshest critics and my best critics. And they continued to want more as I went along, which was the indication that they liked it. They're voracious readers, and they will read until they get bored. And so we have tons of books in our house that have bookmarks in them and halfway through that they got bored with. This one they made it all the way through, which was the biggest thumbs up I could get.
Did you make any changes along the way because of what their feedback was?
Yeah, absolutely. I did. I tried to keep it as true to my heart as I could and make it as much me as I could, but you can't help but be influenced by your children and what they like and what they respond to. And mostly it was what they understood. If I had written something and they didn't quite get it, it wasn't landing the way I wanted it to land, I would rewrite it for them and ask them again, okay, does this make more sense? Are you getting what I'm trying to get across now? And they were pretty great critics.
Must be nice to have a focus group in the house.
Yes, it is.
So you're hoping to make this a trilogy. When do you anticipate at least the second one coming out?
Oh, that's the question that my boys keep asking. I don't know. I'm starting this new show for Nickelodeon, Ricky, Nicky, Dicky, and Dawn, and it is an all-encompassing startup process. I'm there all the time, every day. So I've just now started to lay out how I want to do the second book, and hopefully I'll be able to carve out some time and get it written this year. Mm. I would love, but who knows?
But the current one is now out there?
Yes, it is now out there, and everyone who has read it has said the same thing, which is hurry up and write the second one, and I would love to move that fast, but I just can't right now.
The book is called Flight of the Akira, The Book of Milo. It's written by Douglas Liebling. And Douglas, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Douglas Liebling, author of Flight of the Akiro, The Book of Milo. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0251, and you'll find the links to Douglas's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will share some barbecue tips. Plus, also, we'll talk about relationships, specifically May-December relationships. The barbecuing and the relationships have nothing in common, by the way. Just telling you that right now. It's not the same interview. It's two separate ones. I'm getting off track, aren't I? Anyway, that's all coming up here on a program that's heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And, you know, as I've mentioned several times, this program is, of course, on Stitcher Smart Radio. And you can listen to not only this show, but 20,000, at least 20,000 other programs on Stitcher Smart Radio. It's radio on the go, on-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone or any other mobile device. The latest episode is always available to you. No syncing needed, no memory, no storage wasted. It's available on your iPhone, iPad, Android phones, and beyond. Downloading is easy. Just simply go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio is the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff, shall we? Well, Texas police are still investigating to see if they can hook anyone with charges after an alleged fish-slapping incident over the weekend. During the incident in Lufkin, a woman supposedly slapped her sister-in-law in the face with a dead catfish. Officers from the Lufkin Police Department responded after receiving a call about a domestic disturbance. The argument allegedly started because a female put a catfish in her sister-in-law's face, according to Sergeant Mike Shirley. An argument then ensued between the woman and her brother, which turned physical. According to the brother, his sister slapped his wife in the face with a fish, and he told her to leave. And eventually she did. All three people who were involved gave statements to the police. According to Shirley, the woman told police that her brother had been beating his wife, a claim that he denied. The man at the scene was arrested on an outstanding warrant, because in these stories, someone always seems to have an outstanding warrant. No other arrests were made, and no charges have been filed involving the catfish at this time. Due to lack of independent witnesses and conflicting stories, the case has been forwarded to the Criminal Investigation Department for further investigation, Shirley said. Yes, there is always a lack of independent witnesses because the catfish is dead, and he ain't talking. So, there you go. Which brings me to another point. The average catfish is at least 10 pounds. It takes a little bit of heft to swing that in a slapping motion, don't you think? Could it be the sister's had some practice and she's not new to fish slapping? I'm just guessing. And for the record, just remember, two women got into a fight and it's the guy who is going to jail. That's all I want to say. A Chinese man and his family are now stuck in South Korea after his four-year-old son turned his father's passport into his latest art masterpiece. The child, possibly feeling his father needed some facial hair, drew him some whiskers and a beard. He also colored in his eyes and drew him some friends, all in black ink. When the father tried to board his flight to China, customs would not let him through to his plane. They are now both stranded in South Korea with no way to get home. It makes for a headache of a holiday, but a great story to tell, doesn't it? Yeah, and I'm also sure that that's the last marker or crayon that that kid will ever see. Now, despite a 1971 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court declaring that governments could not punish people who were merely annoying, dozens of towns, according to a March Wall Street Journal report, continue to regard the behavior as criminal. The justices decided the word is too vague to give fair warning of which behaviors are illegal, but an Indiana deputy attorney general told the Journal that anyone with ordinary intelligence knows what is annoying. New York has such a law, as do Lawrence, Massachusetts, and Cumberland, Maryland, among the 5,000 mentions of forms to annoy in a computer search of municipal ordinances. Now, Britain's House of Lords in January blocked a proposed anti-annoyance law. So, anyone with ordinary intelligence knows what is annoying. Okay, so how do we determine who has ordinary intelligence? Yeah, that's a sliding scale in some cases. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, legal gymnastics are being used to try to prevent an Arizona woman from performing cartwheels at public meetings in Phoenix. Diane D.D. Barker received a cease and desist letter from an attorney for the Maricopa Association of Governments telling her to immediately stop performing cartwheels at MAG meetings. You have from time to time suggested that MAG cannot prevent you from performing cartwheels during your comments, according to the letter. That position is incorrect. The 65-year-old sent back an email in protest saying that not being able to perform cartwheels would limit her ability to freely speak or express in such positive conviction my continuing commitment and unwavering support of MAG's transportation, air quality, duty, and directives. Whatever the heck that means, I have no idea what that statement means, but anyway. And why does she need to do cartwheels? So that the blood will get to her head? Anyway, Barker first discovered she was good at cartwheels when she was a cheerleader at Ohio State University. I think that the cartwheel is something I found out that I could do that is enjoyable, and it definitely expresses my passion, Barker said. Yeah, she plans to follow the letter of the law at meetings, but that's about it. The cartwheel isn't the end of it. I'm walking down the wall backwards and getting myself in shape for doing the back over, Barker said. You know, perhaps someone should litter the floor with tacks or Legos before the next meeting. That'll put an end to things, wouldn't it? Yeah. Anyway, on to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Anybody who listens to this show regularly or follows me on Facebook or Twitter knows that I like to barbecue. Love to barbecue. And the sign of a true Canadian is someone who will do it year-round. But for a lot of people, we are now in the height of the barbecue season. So I thought it would be nice to have a chat with Ron Shuchuk. I first spoke to Ron on our old radio show when his book, Barbecue Secrets, came out. It's a book that is near and dear to me, so I thought it would be nice to have Ron on this program. So he joins us on the line via Skype to Skype Communications from Vancouver. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Peter. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you on the program. I don't know why I waited so long to have you on this particular show, since, like I said, your book is always near and dear to me. As a matter of fact, I have it right here in my hot little hands.
Thank you. Well, you know, you had to perfect your podcast.
Exactly.
And now it's perfect. So there now you can have me on.
Yeah. So, you know, there's so many things, and I often talk to people about barbecue tips.
Yes.
So I want to know from your perspective, what's the biggest mistake people make when they barbecue?
Well, I've always said this, and it's just walking away from the grill. For 90% of the things that people actually put on a grill, whether it's a chicken breast or a steak or a smoky or whatever it is, it really doesn't take more than 2 or 3 minutes per side to cook something. Maybe if for a thicker steak or something you really need to cook through, maybe it's 10 minutes. But people walk away and forget whatever they're cooking is on the grill. They come back and the thing looks like a hockey puck. So my biggest piece of advice is enjoy the process, stick around, have a sip of a drink, have some music out, create an outdoor room for yourself that you can cook in, and stick around. You can spare the 10 minutes to grill something perfectly rather than walking away and risking it being ruined.
Now, I've got a barbecue that heats up from 0 to 500 in a heartbeat.
What kind is it?
And you got me stumped now.
That's okay. But you have a very powerful, you got lots of BTUs.
I got lots of BTUs, definitely do. But one of the things I've noticed with, especially when friends come over, and if I say to a friend, you know, can you light that for me? And it also lights very quickly. Mm-hmm. One of the things I notice is that, for me, most people turn their, and I use propane, most mm-hmm. people turn the propane on too high, like too open, I should say. It takes very little.
Yeah, it does. I mean, my advice is to, if you have a propane or gas grill, when you preheat it, keep it on high, but only preheat it for maybe 10 or 15 minutes. That's all you need.
Right.
If you actually keep the heat on high for much longer than that, you're starting to actually destroy the burners and you're decaying the metal of the grill because it shouldn't really be that hot for that long. There's also nothing wrong with putting your grill on medium and heating it up for a little longer. I think that the lower the heat that you use on your grill, the longer it'll last.
Ah, good point. I've only had, and I, as I said, I'm somebody who barbecues year-round. I've only had 2 barbecues. And that's in a span of since about 1993.
Uh-huh. Well, and you probably bought a name brand grill. That's one of the things that I always advise people in terms of their gear is if you buy a good quality grill, I like Weber, but there's also Napoleon and there's other name brands that are out there. First thing is you know that it's well engineered, but the second thing is you know you can get spare parts for it. So I might have my grill. If it's a name brand grill, I might have it for 20 years, and maybe every 5 or 8 years, I have to replace the burners or get a new cooking grate, or the knobs have been broken. But you know that there's going to be spare parts, and that's a huge thing.
And one of the other things, because it's come across, I've seen this in my other my daytime job, as the saying goes, on the global news programs. We're hearing more and more stories about the concerns of people who use the scrapers to clean off their grills and the little bristles coming out and people having to go to hospital because they unwittingly ingest these things and it causes...
Really?
Oh, yeah. We've seen more and more stories of this in the last little while where the bristles become dislodged when people are scraping the barbecue grills. And, of course, they clean it off with this thing. The bristle gets stuck on the grill. They don't really see it. They put the meat on it. It then gets soaked up into the meat.
And then it embeds itself into their digestive tract and they can't get it out?
And or it rips their digestive tract.
Oh, for goodness sake. Yeah. I mean, I've never heard of that. And I don't even know what advice to give. I would just say, after you've scraped your grill, take a close look at it for any debris before you put your meat on. Use a high quality scraper and maybe you won't have the problem. But boy, I've never even heard of that.
Well,
that's kind of scary.
This brings me to a question. When do you clean the grill? Do you clean the grill after you've used it so that it's prepared for the next time or just before you're planning to use it?
Just before. I mean, I grills, even stainless steel ones, but if I have cast iron grills, anything, they're going to corrode. And if you leave the mung on them from the last time you cooked, there's natural oils in there that are going to naturally protect it from corrosion. So when I fire up my grill, that's when I burn off the last the debris from the last cooking.
Okay. Now, I mentioned the book, Barbecue Secrets, the very best recipes, tips, and tricks from a barbecue champion, and that would be you.
Thanks. And actually, the latest book is called Barbecue Seekers Deluxe. It came out a couple of years ago, and it's the best of the first two books that I had, Barbecue Secrets and Planking Secrets, plus a bunch of new recipes and photographs. And it's available in bookstores and as well as one of those iBooks through for the Kindle or for the iPad.
Well, I failed to say the word deluxe because it's actually the deluxe one that I'm holding in my hand.
Oh, right on.
With an absolutely juicy burger on the cover.
Yummy.
I'm sure you hear this all the time, but I got to ask you, with all the things that you do, what's your favorite?
Wow, that's a great question. If I had a choice, sort of a desert island dish that I would do, it would be really hard to decide between just a great porterhouse steak or a T-bone steak, just grilled really simply with salt and pepper, and then at the last minute, drizzled with a little bit of olive oil and a squeeze of lemon, or rotisserie jerk chicken. I love jerk. Jerk is one of my favorite foods. I've been to Jamaica a couple of times, and the flavors and the intensity and of real jerk, it is irresistible. So I'd say it's a tie between jerk chicken and a beautifully grilled steak. And I shouldn't betray, myself here, or a perfectly sliced Texas barbecue brisket. Because I have to say something about barbecue, which is one of my specialties. A really great brisket that you've cooked lovingly for 18 hours in a smoker or a barbecue pit. There is nothing like a slice of the fattiest, most juicy, smoky brisket.
I chuckled because when you mentioned jerk chicken on the rotisserie jerk chicken, that is actually something I do on the barbecue. So we tend to agree on that one. One of the other things I've always found interesting is that you little tips and things. For instance, I remember talking to you on a previous occasion and just the idea of something that a lot of us do, and in my case used to do, things like spraying Pam on your grill and then starting it up so that you can use it, and then not realizing, well, duh, the Pam is going to burn off before you even get your meat onto the grill. And you suggested using something like olive oil on the meat.
Yes, that's what I mean. In fact, I do that. A lot of chefs will take a rag or a paper towel, drizzle it with oil, and rub that on the grill just before cooking. And if you want to be super careful about things not sticking, I suppose that's a technique. But I think it's a bit too chefy for me, if you know what I mean. I like to just drizzle some oil, olive oil, on my steak or my chicken breast or whatever. And that actually helps. And you just make sure that your grill is nice and hot and scraped very clean, and you don't have to oil the grill.
Well, when I tell people this tip, which I got from you, they think I'm so intelligent. And of course, at that time, I tell them, well, no, it's not me, it's you. And it gives me a chance to plug your book again. So your book makes me look smart, which is, I think, the best thing I can say about your book to people out there who might be thinking of buying it. One of the other things, we just running out of time, and that is everyone has their favorites, and your book is so chock full of great barbecue ideas. But how do you get people off the pot, as it were, to try something in your book that looks so delectable and the pictures look great, but maybe not is in their comfort zone when they're grilling?
Well, I would say plank cooking would be something I think is people are often intimidated by, but it's really easy. And the thing that is most satisfying, the kind of feedback that I've gotten over the years from my books, is that I pay a lot of attention. I'm kind of a writer and a journalist at heart, and I pay a huge amount of attention to the instructions to make them clear and complete and easy to understand. And I think that if you walk through pretty much any of the recipes in my book, you'll find that.
Excellent. And again, the book is Barbecue Secrets Deluxe, the very best recipes, tips, and tricks from a barbecue champion. People can check out your website at ronshuchuk.com, and they'll find links in the Stuff File on the Stuff File webpage for the What's On page for this week. Ron, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Thanks, Peter. It's been a pleasure.
Ron Shuchuk, author of Barbecue Secrets Deluxe, the very best recipes, tips, and tricks from a barbecue champion. Again, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0251, and you'll find links to Ron's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. In today's competitive job market, one thing almost every college student hopes to get before they graduate is an internship. Students know that one of the best ways to get the experience they need is to get an internship when they're still in school. Unfortunately, it's getting harder to find internships these days because of lawsuits. In recent years, unpaid interns have sued Harper's Magazine, talk show host Charlie Rose, and many others, claiming that they should have been paid. Some lawsuits resulted in huge payouts. For example, Charlie Rose had to pay up to $250,000. Let's be fair, what student wouldn't like to get paid? The problem, however, is that college counselors now say lawsuits have prompted some employers to stop offering internships. Magazine publisher Condé Nast ended its intern program. There is one place, however, that students can't sue, so it still offers unpaid internships. It's called the White House, home to the President of the United States. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
Informed or entertained? Hey, you're doing both. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about May-December relationships. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, but right now, a few more Stuff File news stories to get to. A student driver and his instructor were driving along Church Lane, Handsworth, England, when the student became, well, displeased about what the teacher was saying. It appears the man owed money for earlier lessons, and when the instructor asked for payment, his student responded aggressively, according to Detective Constable Darren Wilkie. The student allegedly stopped the car, punched the instructor, and walked away. And then, while the instructor was calling police, returned, punched and kicked the instructor, and drove away in the school's car. The 22-year-old student was arrested at his home. The courts will be more willing, I'm sure, than the driving school to teach him lessons. And by the way, I wasn't aware that road rage was now part of the curriculum. And finally, an obese North Carolina man is facing multiple heroin trafficking charges after he was allegedly caught with numerous bags of heroin crammed into his belly button. According to Greenville police, their regional drug task force searched the vehicle that he was driving during a traffic stop and found over 150 bags and $1,200. Now, one of the occupants, the rather hefty Randall Streeter, allegedly had 40 bags of heroin stashed in his navel. Streeter also allegedly had crack and Percocet pills lodged in himself. Gee. I wonder where they were lodged. Passenger Wayne Marshall Wilson was also charged with heroin trafficking, and 340 bags of heroin were found overall. The estimated value of the seized heroin, $6,800. You know, they say that drugs will make you do strange things. I think this story just proved it. Anyway, let's get to our next guest, shall we? Relationship coach Frank Kermit is back on the program. He's a best-selling author, educator, relationship columnist, and a certified hypnotherapist. Frank joins us on the line once again via Skype-to-Skype communication to talk this time about May-December relationships. Hi, Frank.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing just fine. Thanks for being on the program with us once again. So we used to hear a lot about May-December relationships. Of course, they still go on, but do they turn as many heads as they used to?
Not as many as they used to. People are a lot more accustomed to seeing the whole concept of May-December relationships, people dating with at least a 20-year age gap, and it's not turning heads as much, although there is still more of a stigma of a much older woman with a younger man than there is about an older man with a much younger woman.
The so-called cougar situation.
Exactly.
Even though, as you say, there is still a bit more of a stigma, even that has changed a little bit, because while people might look negatively toward it to a slight degree now, before it was just like forbidden.
It was more than forbidden. It was actively discouraged. People would step in and use shame and guilt and how could you and why are you wasting your time? This relationship can't go anywhere. The only reason you're getting together is for sex, because there's no way you're ever going to produce children in this relationship. And that's really a big part of the underlying reason that it was a stigma. Nowadays, people tend to mind their own business, live and let live, do whatever you want to do as long as it doesn't interfere with my life. And if a couple of people are deciding they like each other's company and they're getting together, they're starting to understand it's nobody's business as long as no one is being hurt.
Okay, so if we're also accepting of this nowadays, are there any pitfalls along the way, anything that should be of concern for someone getting in a May-December relationship, regardless of which end of the year you are in?
Okay, let's be realistic here. A May-December relationship means that there are some bigger risks you take than dating people in your own age group. And that is, the chances are much higher that the older partner is going to die off years before the younger partner does. Now, with all that said, we do have cases where people are in the same age category and someone dies either from natural causes, an accident. It can happen, people die in work-related situations. So there is no guarantee. Anybody can, step out on the sidewalk one day and an accident happens and they're gone. With all that said, if people are dying of natural causes and your partner happens to be 20 or 30 years older than you, chances are very high that you're going to be the surviving partner if you're younger. So if you are thinking about wanting to be with somebody long term and they are much older than you, you do have to realize that the odds are against the two of you having as much time together as a couple who are in the same age group.
But I guess, some people could just look at the odds of the situation. The reality is that sadly, especially if you're talking marriage, more than 50% of relationships break up. So if you get into a relationship even with someone of your own age, chances are, even if neither one of you dies off, that you still won't be in for the long haul.
That's right. The statistics are against that. The question is, are you willing to hedge your bets and see if you're going to be part of that 50% of marriages that do survive and to have a partner for long term? In addition to that, there's always the question of whether or not you're going to have kids. An older man and a younger woman, statistically speaking, do have a chance to start a family, regardless how old he may be. A man does not have the same kind of biological clock that a woman does. If he decides that he has a younger partner, a younger wife, he can start a new family at any time. The same cannot be said of older women and younger men. For this reason, a lot of older women are starting to find out that these young guys enjoy being with these women, but don't want to commit to them. Some of these younger guys are just enjoying the company. They're enjoying the sex. Many of the younger men that I speak to use the reason that they don't need to use protection when they're sleeping with an older woman because she can't get pregnant. And a lot of older women also don't practice safe sex for this same reason. However, in the United States, 10% of all new AIDS cases every year are women over 50. So this is starting to get very serious. There are a number of risks that people don't factor in. And for older women who aren't dating younger men, if that younger man does even want the option, and I'm talking about he doesn't necessarily know if he wants his own kids, but he would like to keep his options open, the chances that he's going to commit to an older woman for very long term is actually the odds are against that. And a lot of older women are starting to realize that, yes, they're enjoying themselves, they're having fun, but any expectation that this is going to be a serious ongoing relationship that is going to, last forever, the odds are just very much against it.
Although in this day and age, with even in younger women, fertility, and younger men too, obviously, because it takes two, with infertility being an issue, more and more people are having children with surrogates. And therefore, the idea that a woman is past childbearing age isn't really an issue anymore.
I work with couples who are struggling and they are looking at surrogates. Let's be mindful, though, that not everybody can afford it. These are very, very expensive practices that only people who have the money can afford it. I have counseled single women who were debating, should I wait to see if I get married, or, you know, do I have the child on my own before it's too late? Some women tell me that the organizations they work with won't work with these women if these women turn 40. So in their late 30s, they're opting to have kids on their own. And if they're using any sort of fertility treatment, these things are very expensive. So yeah, it is an option, but it's an expensive option. There's no guarantee. And even after you spend all that money, you still may wind up in the same situation as when you started. So let's also keep in mind that in cases where a surrogate sometimes is used, one parent doesn't always necessarily bond with the child. At one time, if a man could not father a child with his wife and she would go to a sperm bank, she would have a stronger bond with the child because it was half hers. And a lot of those marriages divorced, statistically speaking. So there are other considerations here.
So getting back to May-December relationships, let's just define what that is. And by that, I mean, how much of an age gap does there have to be for it to be considered a May-December relationship?
From what I've experienced, 20 years seems to be the minimum number. If there's a minimum 20-year age gap, it's considered a May-December relationship. Sometimes you have couples that are 10 years apart, and people don't really bat an eye for that. 15 years apart, they're really not going to call it May-December. But at the 20-year mark, there's something about the 2-0 that seems to put it in their heads that, okay, this is a generation apart.
Isn't also one of the reasons why it's certainly more acceptable nowadays than it was generations ago is that the idea of what an older person is, be they male or female, is radically different from what it used to be. I mean, you know, let's look at, and I know that the people who work in the media are not exactly the role models of society, but looking at a Jane Fonda today does not equate to someone of her age 40 years ago.
I would have to agree with that on some level, just because the social norms and the expectations of what was desired from a person of a certain age, people were basically told how to behave and what they should want and what they should expect, including things like, if you are a widow, the chances that you would get married again are slim to none. You should just devote yourself to your children and your grandchildren, and getting remarried, well, that's just preposterous. You don't need to. And that's all changed. Now you have people who are starting their lives over at various ages, coming out of divorces, broken families, separations. And what we consider now to be an active 50-year-old, an active 60-year-old, when someone isn't even 70 and then passes on, the argument is, oh, how young that person was. Because our life expectancy has increased. Our expectations have increased. People now are starting to realize also that they may not die just a handful of years after retirement. They may continue to live on another 10, 20, 30 years if they're healthy and they take care of themselves. So we're going into a completely undiscovered country.
It's a fascinating topic indeed, Frank, and it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. People can check out your website, franktalks.com. What will people find when they go there?
Well, they're going to find my newsletter, where if you sign up for my newsletter at franktalks.com/newsletter, you get my 13th book, 400 pages, over 100 of my best articles that I've written over the last few years.
Frank, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's always a pleasure. I look forward to the next time.
Relationship coach Frank Kermit. You can check out his website at franktalks.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0251, and you'll find the link to his site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
While investigating a robbery in a Duluth, Minnesota residence, police determined that the victim's credit card had been used by the resident of a nearby home. They executed a search warrant at the home of 27-year-old Tommy Morgan and found the victim's jewelry, purses, and phone inside. Now, when officers returned the next day to arrest Morgan, he claimed he couldn't have committed the robbery because he was out of town at the time. Investigators had already placed him at the scene of the crime, though, because Morgan wears a GPS ankle bracelet, as is the condition of his release for another pending robbery charge. Morgan had allegedly cut off the bracelet the day after the robbery. Okay, now why would someone who's wearing an ankle monitor commit a robbery, then cut off the monitor the day after, and then tell police he was out of town during the robbery even though he was caught red-handed with all the loot? Well, one reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0251. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find links and information on our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, it's 0251. Email me at thestufffile.com. And you can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.